and dismounts, shoving his way through the gathered folk, cursing fluently at every soul in his path. Artan is nearly dizzy with relief. Sink! Two mounted Thebans push back the retreating crowd, weapons in hand, threatening the onlookers, urgent and adamant with downed comrades bleeding on the street. A second pair bangs on adjacent doors, threatening to break them down, searching for the sniper. Obdurate, they'll ride their horses right inside if people don't cooperate. Now Artan can see Chorus and Sink, bent over two fallen Thebans in the beautiful dusk. Chorus looks at Sink and shakes his head. Another Theban, herding civilians, calls out.
Aegis and Archaeus, are they dead?
More banders are arriving. Horses slip sliding to a stop on cobblestones. Sink has his head close to a fallen man's chest and doesn't answer. One wounded man moans.
Not dead, Chorus calls back. We got here in time,
proudly.
But bad. Throwing stars. Poisoned, probably. The kind we have. And crossbow shot for good measure.
That's more porking detail than anybody needs right now, porker, critiques Gale as the veteran stepson struggles to hold two skittish horses nervous from the smell of blood.
It's great you happened along, Sink,
Artan says into the awkward silence, trying to sound brave in the face of yet more unreasoning violence come from nowhere. His eyes search every shadow, every doorway, every hedge and iron fence. There are so many sacred band fighters here now. The citizens are pressed back against the buildings by a wall of men and horseflesh, but still want to gawk.
Great, Sink repeats dryly, hands pressing around a crossbow bolt in one man's chest.
Damned hellhole. Damned kids. Damned mess.
Sink curses, gentle and regretful, a softer tone than he'd used to curse the crowd. He cranes his neck, judging the men standing by, awaiting orders.
You two pairs, bring me water, blankets if you can. Keep searching, house to house, roofs and cellars. Go, go, go!
He points. Two teams move off fast, blustering to console themselves, toward the hedges and the well-kept homes.
Gorgias, Siren, get a cart. These men aren't riding out of here. Strad, is that you there? Help me. We need to stop some bleeding here. Bring any packing you've got.
One pair rides off to get a cart. Other pairs are stalking, creating a perimeter with their horses, looking everywhere, shields up, swords out, snarling at passers-by and onlookers still lingering. Now Stratton shoves through.
Bleeding's good if there's poison, Sink.
Artan, don't just stand there staring. Track the shooter.
Chorus, you too. And get these civilians out of here unless they're volunteering to be victims. Now!
That battlefield voice clears the street of the last curious, like a wind blowing leaves. Strat joins Sink, kneeling over the wounded, a saddlebag in his hand. Flint strikes, flare and flame, knife glittering, heating. Then a soft, sizzling sound. Someone moans and someone coughs, too wetly. Artan, sword sheathed, crossbow up to his face, is searching every shadow with narrowed eyes. Wood cracks and snaps as if a shaft has broken. A shout of agony rings out, just one. Then silence. Strat is leaning low over one wounded man, listening to his breathing. Sink stands up and wipes his hands on his hips, saying under his breath, "Our shooter is trying to make a statement. Nice of your necromant to warn us, Strat. Maybe a little sooner next time?" Strat says, "I'll be sure to tell her you said so." Gale calls out, "Where's that porking cart? These boys can still bleed to death out here." Cora's hands and knees bloody, eyes huge in the fading dusk, is craning his neck, turning in place, staring all around, looking for the enemy in every deepening shadow. Artin could nearly hear him worrying. "Sham's still out here." So Artin says, "We're targets, out here, just like they were. The shooter's still here, somewhere, watching us." Sink shrugs, sucking blood from his thumb. "Right you are. Put on your damn helmet. Want to get shot in the head? This Pud's out to scare us and the locals. If he were looking for more kills tonight, he'd have struck again by now. Plenty of easy targets." His grin flashes in his helmet's narrow slit. Strat spits over one shoulder.
"He's not going to risk getting caught outnumbered by an adversary on the alert. He's having too much fun."
Sink says, "Anybody want to guess who our shooter might be? In case the necromant's warning's not proof enough?" No one does. Everybody knows. End of chapter 19. Chapter 20. Divine Lovers and Beloveds. At the barracks amphitheater, sunlight was breaking through the clouds. Karen saw it as a good omen. All night thunderheads had threatened, their lightning pulsing somewhere far away, with only a few stars shining like beacons on a wine-blue sea. He'd had his wounded brought in secretly under cover of darkness. Few of his knew yet, a trusted few who'd brought them home, about the injured Theban fighters in the barracks. Soon they would hear. He had to tell them carefully. In this country where weather told the temper of the gods and prophesied men's futures, Karen was grateful that the sun was shining bright this morning. Weather and events on earth and in heaven echoed and re-echoed here, with preternatural results. A storm on the night his wounded were brought back bleeding and bandaged to their barracks, even a Theban knew by now, would have predicted hell to pay. But no storm broke last night or this morning. Therefore, the storm god, Enlil, was not affronted, or wroth, or worse. Impossibly, unappeasably, he wanted to go home to Thebes, to the world that spawned him. Stand on the cliffs, walk the hills, work his sheepdogs, eat grapes from his own arbor. Loss overcame him with a wrenching homesickness so deep he couldn't see anything but the green hills of his farm. Then it was gone, leaving sudden weakness in its wake. So how must they feel, all of his, trusting his word to lead them on? Before anyone was allowed near the wounded, Karen called his band together in the arena. His 21 pairs, healthy enough to sit in the amphitheater, and his injured son, Lysis. "Brothers," he said to them, "once again, beloved friends among us have been saved from perishing.
Aegis and Archaeus were brought home last night by stepsons after being attacked in the city. Give thanks that they live. He paused to let angry mutters crest and break like swells on a beach. He'd known they would take it ill, this violence come from nowhere, again. There is too much disrespect brewing here, too little gratitude, when Harmony and the stepsons who saved us once from death keep saving us, again and again, he said into the morning light where his pairs sat shocked, some with arms around each other, on the primeval stone slabs encircling the ruined arena. We are who and what we are, because Harmony has given us consonance and order, mollified our strong and impetuous natures, brought our warrior's force and courage into train with the divine love we share with one another. Let us recall how fleeting life is. Here we are one step farther away from our fallen brothers and one step closer to Elysian. With no Thebes to serve here, our service is due to our goddess and one another, and the memory of our lost land and companions. Cleave closer to your friends, and that friendship inspired by our goddess. Pay respect to her, and to your comrades, the stepsons. He waited a moment. No one said a word. The Theban band now sat closer together, by twos and fours, not huddled, but not at ease. Today we give thanks. Without breastplates, without swords girded on, without anger at our lot. Give thanks today, I say, instead of curses, that Lysis, Aegis, and Archaeus will live to fight on other days. He crossed his arms. He wore a kirtle, sandals, and a cord knotted at his waist. His head was bare, and the wind blew through his hair, so short yet from when he'd shorn it, to honor his brothers fallen at Chaeronea. Gorgias, one of his best warriors, said in a low growl, "But we're dying here." Gorgias and his partner had helped bring home the wounded pair. Charon replied, "Gorgias, men die everywhere. It is man's nature to gain life and to lose it, as it is to give life and to take it." As he'd asked, everyone had come unarmed. There was a hidden danger here, among these strange warfighters in this unforgiving land, with their uncompromising honor and their harsher definition of heroism, that the unique nature of the sacred band of Thebes could be lost. Siren, Gorgias's fiery partner, said, "Why is it we are always the targets of the angry fates? Twice as many men of ours met harm as did theirs, since we've come here." "There it was," said aloud. Charon looked at Lysis, his young hero in the first row with his maple crutch, and beamed. His son stared back at him, sober and proud. Inspired by Lysis's brave young face, he said, "Siren, there are more than twice as many Thebans here as stepsons. Can you count? Or ask my son, who remembers all we've done, if we Thebans fall easily." Long spears thunking into flesh, men staggering back, impaled, moaning. "Ask yourself if the gods are angry. You who have seen harmony come among us, walk among us, touch us, look kindly upon us. We are the sacred band of Thebes. We fight in the forefront, therefore we bleed first. We live, therefore we die.
He bowed his head and knew the others would.
Our goddess Harmony has appeared to us here. She blesses us and our sojourn, and forgives us for leaving our brothers on the battle plain. Forgive yourselves, although so many of us are dead, that you still live. We bring suffering upon our own heads when we are ungrateful to the gods that we yet live to fight on other days.
It couldn't have been said a moment sooner. Hearts were still too sore, grief too fresh. But now we end the grieving. We have a new enemy, chaos, here, and we will fight this foe with our new brothers and all our might, put to work once more in a worthy cause. And then began the questions and answers, the flood of hidden tears he'd known must some day come. He stood silently while men and boys spoke freely of all they'd lost and comrades slain and let their tide of sorrow flow until it ebbed. When they were quiet and looked with red and swollen eyes to him once more, he said,
"Now you are fit to welcome our new heroes, Aegis and Archias, and to thank our stepson brothers for a rescue once again. We plan a formal Theban feast, some already know, at full moon, to show our gratitude and celebrate life with the greater sacred band, with whom we share our passion and our allegiance."
Lysis was looking at him proudly, with shining eyes. Charond didn't need a better omen of how this effort was received.
"Cherish one another, and if some die, or some are wounded, or all die between now and the fate or thereafter, are we not still the sacred band of Thebes? And are we not now all stepsons? Our adopted brothers fight by our sides, and together we will continue to meet our enemies with sharp eyes and firm resolve. Between now and our feast day, all of you think how you will show your thanks and share your joy that life yet resides within you. Show it to Harmony, and to the Storm God Enlil, whose place this is, and to the Riddler, and the greater sacred band of which we are now a part." Men whooped and clapped their partners on the back, and chatter broke out. Some embraced as if they would hold on forever. Charond left the center of the amphitheater and joined his son, helping Lysis cope with his crutch. The boy put his left arm around Charon's shoulders. Charond slid his right arm around Lysis's waist and said, "Now, Lysis, you're fit to see Aegis and Archias and praise the goddess for their survival and them for their bravery."
With Lysis hobbling along, the others surged ahead. He'd lost one pair of his. The stepsons had lost a pair. And he had three wounded since coming to Sanctuary. Graver wounds still showed this day on bodies and in hearts, so the men were right to be concerned. It seemed as if they'd come here accursed. When he and Lysis climbed out of the amphitheater at last, fighters were queued up to visit the wounded in their sickbeds. He wanted them focused on tomorrow, not on yesterday. He wanted the feast to heal and unify them. If fighting for Thebes was denied them, then fighting for each other, for memory and for their goddess, must be enough. He wanted another sign from Harmony, if the goddess would allow. Gorgias, brown of hair and eye and skin, who'd been on the scene when the badly wounded Thebans were found, came up to him and said,
"Charon, can I speak to you alone?"
"Lysis, hold a place in line for me." They watched the youth hobble off to join the queue. Soon he wouldn't need the crutch.
"So, how are you, Gorgias? It's time to play our pipes and flutes and tend our wounded heroes. And to thank you for all you did, getting them back here alive, to heal."
Gorgias said,
"Let's walk."
They did, up toward the altar of Enlil.
"Do you think we could have an altar to Harmony here?"
Gorgias asked. "I think they would allow it. I'll ask, at the feast." Gorgias was not a forthcoming man, but a worthy warrior, so Charon prompted, "Have you a problem? A question?"
"I have information and questions."
"So, say."
"We have 22 pairs left, one of which is wounded, and Lysis, nearly healed. 44 fighters, you included. Why do they tell us what to do?"
Gorgias had a face of broken bones knit roughly, a scar from his right eye to his mouth.
"Because we agreed it so. The Agenes did, for all of us, the night before the battle."
"Because we are here in their country, and so we abide by their rules, their gods."
"But we never all agreed, man by man, pair by pair."
"We are the sacred band of Thebes, and now the greater sacred band. I have said to their leader that we are all stepsons. We will keep our word, as honor demands." Climbing this gentle hill was difficult today. Charon's lungs labored. But sometimes breath can bait from words, not deeds. Above was only Enlil's modest altar, a pile of stones hardly dressed, and the deep blue sky wearing fluffy clouds of white.
"Equality must be maintained if it is promised." "Within order and rank and clear chain of command. Don't do this, Gorgias. We have too much to learn from them yet."
The smashed profile of Gorgias beside him moved inexorably up the hill. Gorgias sighed deeply.
"As you wish, then. For now.
Do you know that their commander, their Riddler, is cursed, some say? Those who love him die of it, and those he loves are bound to spurn him. Where does that put us?"
"Don't get too friendly with him, I'd advise. If you believe in curses. I've heard the tale. I myself don't think any curse can withstand a god."
"Tempest nearly is one. Would be in Thebes.
Anyway, I've heard the curse is lifted, if there ever was one. They say he's eternal. And I know some of these men, Nico, Stratton, Critias, Sink, have been with him 16 years or more. If his men die of loving him, it takes a while." "So you don't think we should worry? You don't think it's true?" "If you don't love him, what difference does it make?"
On the hilltop, they turned around and looked down the blue-green slope at the estate and the training field, where white walls and fences and buildings sparkled.
"If I don't love him, none. And I don't. But if it's true, what if he loves us?"
End of chapter 20. Chapter 21, Evening Parade. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. Hidden behind the lighthouse on the sandy spit, marching drums ring out. Tat, rat-a-tat. Louder than the surf and as compelling. In the full moon night, drums beat and bang. Wooden sticks clack. Tat, rat-tat, tat-a-tat-a-tat. Stepson's horses, rattled by the persistent drum beats, neigh and neigh across the sand spit, calling to each other. From black shadows, bright moonlight. Tempest calms his mount, making the Tros halt in place out near the jetty. Parade rest. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. 10 bonfires crackling. Blaze on the beach. Logs stand on end, head high. Painstakingly propped together at the center, conical fires, carefully constructed and controlled, flames reaching heavenward. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. The rhythm beats louder now, drums approaching. 160 male guests crane their necks, peering toward the drum rolls in the moon's uncanny light. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat-tat. This cadence, sharp as swords clashing, so mournful, so angry, so brave, so proud, can force a rank to war or a bridegroom down the aisle, or bring a body to a funerary pyre, or 10, or 100, or more. Tempest has heard it often. It's in his pulse. It's in his soul. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. Although he'd helped make this plan, knows what's coming. The rhythm raises every hair and makes his heart beat fast. He touches his chest, a customary gesture, one he's made so many times before. Before the wound was there, scar pulsing under his hand. Before Chironea, long spear thunking into flesh. Before this Theban ceremony on a sanctuary shore. Tat, rat-tat, tat-a-tat-a-tat. A melody rises above the drumbeat, bright and fierce and lonely on the beach as flutes and pipes take up this ancient song. Brum-rum-pa-bum-bum. Brum-rum-pa-bum-bum. Tempest looks for Nico but can't find him among the shadows and so many guests. He can see the Thebans now, marching toward the bonfires, four by four with empty litters on their shoulders. To the death with honor, these men are saying. They won't need litters to bring their wounded home. There will be none. Just their dead. Brum-rum-pa-bum-bum. Brum-rum-pa-bum-bum. Flames dance over the armored fighters, reflecting from shields and greaves and arm guards. Helmets glisten. Horsehair crests wave and pennants snap in a wind blowing off the sea. Tonight this sacred band of Thebes wears its best armor, polished and oiled. Tat, rat-a-tat. Cuirasses gleam, tat-rap-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. Toward roaring bonfires at regimented pace come the men by fours. Tat-rat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. Now the rhythm is hypnotic. Hearts beat fast and heads are high.
Brum-rum-pa-pum-pum. Brum-rum-pa-pum-pum.
All the guests are mesmerized, transfixed, until the Thebans reach their designated bonfires. Tat, rat-a-tat,
brum-rum-pa-pum-pum.
The war fighters halt before the flames. So does the rhythm. Silence rules unexpectedly. So abruptly does this march end, which has been with men in battle for eons. The quiet seems too loud. From behind the lighthouse, naphtha fireballs arc high, out over the sea, and fall, green tails streaming out behind like arrows from the gods. Assaulted, the sea seems to stop pounding the beach. At the fireball signal, in perfect synchrony, one man before each chosen balefire adds a wicker litter to the flames. Hungry fires roar and spit, sending sparks aloft. Drums roll again, flutes and pipes call anew. Tat, rat-a-tat,
brum-brum-rum-pa-pum-pum.
Tat, rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. The sacred band of Thebes, stepping crisply back, turns in unison at a shout from its leader, and marches toward the lighthouse and the shadows. Tat, rat-a-tat,
tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat.
Now the rhythm fades, flutes, pipes, and drums receding. Ever softer in the night, while the men march away as they had come. Proud and perfect, this band of brothers. Drilled and ready, marching off to heaven or the lighthouse on the spit, whatever the gods decide, in strict formation. Then all that can be heard are one flute and one drum, then that single lonely drum, until the last Theban warrior is swallowed by the dark. Tat, rat-a-tat, tat-rat-tat-tat-a-tat-a-tat. Then silence, no sound at all, nothing. The surf decides to swell and pound once more. It crashes on the jetty, rustles up the shore. As guests begin uncertainly to talk and wander toward food or drink, Nico finds Tempus. Nico's mare and Tempus's stallion nicker greetings as Nico brings her alongside. Riddler, where were you? What will we do when the dignitaries appear, without you close at hand?
I've been right here the whole time, watching for uninvited guests from the sea. Although he hadn't been, really. Don't fret, Nico. If you must, you can handle this without me.
There is something in the water tonight, coming in from the sea. He feels it, but doesn't tell Nico. Whatever it is, they'll face it by and by.
No, I can't,
It's you our guests have come to see, not Thebans, not me.
A wind gusted, fanning the flames of 10 bonfires. Touched by fire and moonlight, Nico's face is somber, jaw set and eyes piercing. Feelings stirred by the Theban play. Stealth, everything flows, Tempest reminds him gently. Our Thebans like a bit of drama with their justice.
Those sanctuarites just got more than a taste of Theban justice, more truth, less party than expected.
It's not our feast, not our agenda. Let the Thebans have this moment. They paid blood for it. We need only keep a balance. You know how to do that, more than any other. This one, of all he had, of all he'd ever had, was the best, but the most complicated.
We're on it, Nico says impatiently, raking back hair from his face as the ocean wind tussles it. But please come. If you snub them, if you don't grace this ceremony with your presence, then what?
Nico gestured toward the celebrants, starting to feast from laden festival boards here and there among the dunes.
Even Enlil is giving us a bright full moon.
He glances at the heavens suspiciously.
I'll come, Tempest says with a sigh, regretful at leaving the seashore.
His best fighters are mixed with the city guard here, doing double duty. Pretending to be celebrating while patrolling, protecting, and hoping to draw out Shamshi, the renegade, preying on them like a panther from the dark.
And you will have some fun tonight. And yours. Fun?
Nico repeats doubtfully as if he's never heard the word.
Fun. That's an order. You are both strung too tight, all you stepsons. We have the city guard to watch our backs. Keep your weapons handy, but join in, as I must. Now that the evening parade is over, circulate. Get yours fed, but not drunk, before the women arrive from the city.
Oh, I see. I promise, Nico said. It's taken care of. That quick, canny grin comes and goes.
Fun. They'll like that. Crit, Strat, Sink, and Walgren's best, torch holders, palace guards. Everyone has orders. They didn't think it fair, but they're doing what we asked them.
The fairest universe is but a heap of rubbish, Nico, piled at random. It's all right to eat a little, drink a little, to ride and walk among them. The palace is sending dancers, priestesses, high-born girls to accommodate the men after the feast is done. Molin's pick of those in sanctuary.
But the perimeter?
Unbreached, so far. He knees his trouse sideways, ending the discussion. Whatever waits, we'll meet it head-on, together. Stealth doesn't answer. Just looks at him askance as their horses amble side by side toward the brighter light of 10 bonfires and the celebration, getting raucous now as men drink wine and beer and ale. In that relative quiet, broken only by hoofbeats and the sea, Tempest still hears the rhythm and the tune, though no marching band is playing now. Brum rum pa bum bum. Tat, rat a tat. Tat rat tat 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 tat. Dirge or stirring march to call war fighters to their destiny, it rings in Tempest's head, matching cadence with his horse's hooves as they ride down among far too many soft and powerful men from the city. now meeting pairs of armored Thebans, helmets in hand, shields still upon their arms, mantles stirring in the sea breeze, as equals for the very first time. And the sea laps the shore, whispering behind his back of things to come.
Fun, by the Riddler's order, Stealth told Crit. Three goblets of wine are all Critias can dare on duty. Ivory screened wagon loads of women and more musicians arrive, and Crit thinks three goblets may have been too much. Fun, for Crit, can be defined as an evening where nothing goes wrong, and nothing's out of order. There are too many people, too many vulnerabilities on this indefensible sandspit for Crit even to hope for that. Keeping mayhem at bay here will be impossible if mayhem wants to come out to play. And come she does soon enough. Mayhem incarnate blows in on wind and wave, a bronzed apparition rising from the sea, coalescing out of riptides and white caps, wearing fish-scale armor. Tall and as muscled as any man, she has a tiny waist and upturned breasts. Then she's striding toward them up the beach.
Strat, look to the shore,
he said in Nisi, elbowing his partner, who is busy trying to explain to a palace oligarch why the Thebans threw their litters on the flames if no one died today.
Do you see what I see?
Strat looks square at Crit over the oligarch's balding head.
Where? What? Oh. Damn this fun to hell.
Strat curses in the mercenary argot, hand on his short sword's pommel. Nothing should be able to swim inland from that direction through Vashanka's rip, a tide so fierce it scours the bottom, making an aqua stripe in the sea.
Don't let on anything's amiss,
Crit advised, his stomach knots.
By Enlil's third and fuzziest ball, it's Gian, Strat swears, unless there's another one.
The little oligarch looked between the two stepsons, speaking an amalgam of foreign tongues, and then said,
You're Critias, I presume. We haven't been introduced, but I've long wanted to meet all you senior Timocrats. You who ruled and are ruled by honor, and understand this ethos of the Riddler's sacred band.
Gods forfend, Crit said in court rankeen.
Pardon me?
The oligarch responded, drawing himself up to his full height.
Please don't take offense. I didn't mean you, oligarch.
Timo-what?
Strat spits, already stalking away toward the shore.
Oligarch, I must go. See to my partner. You know how these things are. Be right back.
But he wasn't going to be back any time soon. Crit had to hustle to catch up with Strat.
So what do you suggest we do about her, Strat?
Gian, Froth daughter, child of Stormbringer the Unbegotten, father of all weather gods, was a sprite of Tempest's long acquaintance, and the last thing anyone needed at a seaside gala in Sanctuary.
"Whatever she says," said Strat sensibly. "We're supposed to keep order here tonight. You are."
Then she was upon them, a copper-skinned, inhuman beauty, her long hair blowing around her not even wet, her eyes filled with glowing red flecks, wearing brown-green bronze scale armor down to her muscular thighs and nothing else.
Stratton! Critias! She grabbed them both and pressed them together against her so that for a moment Crit couldn't breathe and his skull knocked against Strat's.
Where's the Riddler? Nika walked into my father's sea and said he needed help. Am I too late? Time is so fluid where I live.
Sah! Swore Strat. Everybody's fine here. No need to trouble yourself. You know how Nico gets. We've got everything under control.
Gian,
said Crit, casting a look over his shoulder to see if anyone was watching.
We're having a little fete. An open house or open spit, so I heard.
Well, lead on, Critias.
Take me to the Riddler.
Now they were in for it. Crit would be lucky if they got through the evening without Gian freezing somebody solid or stripping the Riddler and having him on the sand in front of their guests. But you couldn't control Gian. He and Strat had trouble pacing her in the shifting sand and firelight. So it took Crit a moment to realize what she'd said.
"What do you mean you heard?"
Crit asked.
"Heard from whom?"
Strat asked simultaneously.
"From Ascalon, of course,"
came Jihan's voice, floating back to them as if on her copper mane.
"The Dream Lord, isn't he here yet?"
"He's coming?" Strat asked dolefully.
"Ascalon? From Meridian?"
Crit asked, but didn't need to hear her answer. If there was one power, one personage who could upset all apple carts and skew all plans for an uneventful fate here tonight, it was the Dream Lord. Ascalon, entelechy of dream and shadow, was once nearly killed by Sime, their commander's mistress, a sorcerer slayer of renown. Steps on legend said that Ascalon's heart was not in his breast, but around his wrist in an obsidian bracelet called the Heart of Ascalon. That he could only die if the bracelet was destroyed. After Sime had tried to kill him and failed, she spent a year as his wife in punishment. Tempest had been enraged, but was powerless to stop it. Ascalon had intruded into the band's affairs for years, courting Nika like a lover, once even spiriting Gian herself away to Meridian, his nightmare realm. But powers such as Gian, Ascalon, and Tempest tolerated one another, if uneasily, since they couldn't overcome or obliterate each other. The entelechy of dreams had even made the Riddler's hell-wheeled chariot and given it to Tempest along with a pair of priceless Ascalonian horses when he took Sime to wife on Wizard Wall. Critias had been there, and Crit knew what he saw on his commander's face that day. If Tempest profoundly hated anyone, it was the Dream Lord, regent of the Seventh Sphere. The last time Crit had seen Ascalon walk the earth, Ranky's emperor had been assassinated and the wizard wars ended by that act. Whenever the Dream Lord appeared, push came to shove, the mighty fell, empires crumbled, and blood was shed among puny humans, like the stepsons. Oh, crap. End of chapter 21. Chapter 22. Playing with Powers. The women arrived in a throng, gilded and perfumed with gleaming skin and shining eyes,
and Chorus was captivated as soon as the first ankle, with bells on, poked out of the first ivory-screened wagon. Musicians followed with their lyres and lutes and harps and bell trees, with their horns and pipes and flutes and tambourines. Chorus and Artin were told by stealth to stay near the leadership. "Artin, you're to find me and tell me immediately if you have any premonitions," Stealth had said. "Chorus, you'll make sure it doesn't rain and stay away from Torchholder unless the Riddler's with you, or I am." Stealth's quietude took the sting from it, and Nico was gone, Klamis swaying, weaving through the crowd in his custom-made enameled armor, and his sword and sheath with the elder gods and the bulls of the storm god, that seemed to writhe like living things in the light of the bonfires. "How does a man get such a panoply, or warrant it?" Chorus was wondering when a tug came upon his arm. He turned, and there was Shomi, her eyes ringed with coal and laughing. He thrilled, standing by Artin behind the Riddler's receiving line, where food and drink were laid out for the senior staff. "Chorus," she said demurely, "will you dance with me first?" A sly challenge came and went on her beautiful lips in the moonlight. He looked at Artin, who was facing the other way, where musicians were getting ready to play.
"I would be honored, Shomi. But drink with me. We have the best food and drink right here."
And it was so. Clams and scallops and crabs and lobsters, corn and yams, all cooked in the sand, were piled upon that table, and wines from places with names Chorus couldn't pronounce. No one had said the women couldn't eat or drink, although they weren't invited to the feast, but were, themselves, the dessert. He'd already heaped Shomi's plate and gotten her a goblet when he saw Artin watching, chewing his lip, and staring disapprovingly at them. Chorus ignored Artin. Here was the most beautiful girl in sanctuary, and here was he, with so many swords to hand here and sell swords from the palace besides. He could slip off with his Shomi into those soft dunes with their grassy crests, and no one would be the wiser. Turbulence began in the throng, and then it was in the receiving line. Something scaled and armored launched itself at the Riddler before short swords could clear scabbards or spears be aimed or crossbows knocked. Its copper-colored legs clamped around his hips, its arms around his neck. Only the Riddler wouldn't have staggered back when this thing accosted him. Chorus was launching himself toward the fray when Nico's hand caught his shoulder and jerked him back. "Easy, warfighter, you don't want a piece of that," he heard Nico say. Then the hand was gone, and Stealth with it. Next he realized that Tempest's arms were about the impossibly small waist of the attacker. A molten-looking female of more than mortal proportions, cradling her to him. And the Riddler was laughing, turning in place, holding her while she was holding him, and folk gave back. Had he ever heard the Riddler laugh before? Had he ever seen a woman wrap her legs and arms around a man with such abandon, in front of everyone? He found his cup and drained it. All around the Riddler his cadre was closing in. The receiving line was reforming. But still, Tempest didn't let the woman go, or she didn't let him go. Practiced stepsons realigned the throng, Nicodemus taking Tempest's place, greeting those who waited in line as if this happened every day.
"Who is she?" Shawmy asked.
Chorus couldn't admit he didn't know. The Riddler lets the copper beauty slide down to the ground, turns her halfway around, one arm across her chest, and holds her there, her hips to his groin, his left hand around her right wrist and nearly on her breast. Someone behind him spoke up.
"That's Jihan, Froth's daughter, Stormbringer's child. Call her a sprite, a sea goddess, or a demigoddess, as you will," said Molin Torchholder, nearly in Chorus's ear.
Torchholder was the one person whom Chorus had been warned by stealth to avoid tonight. He hadn't seen the priest since that strange interview in the palace when the god had come up in him so high that for the first time he didn't doubt that Vashanka was really there inside him. Someone refilled his drink. Chorus took his cup, Shawmy on his arm.
"Shawmy, this is His Eminence, Priest of Vashanka, Molin Torchholder. Eminence, this is my beloved friend, Shawmy."
In the firelight, Molin's face seemed to fall as, behind, musicians started tuning up. He looked Shawmy over in a way that Chorus found offensive and then said,
"Dear, join the other dancers. You've work to do tonight."
Before Chorus could object, Shawmy flushed, dropped her head, and scurried away.
"We can do better for you than that, Giscaris."
"Better? What if I don't want to do better? What if I want her and no other?"
He shouldn't have drunk so much. He took a step toward Torchholder, the Froth daughter, and the Riddler forgotten. Out to sea, the sky lit fitfully. Torchholder gives back one step. Chorus takes another step, and the priest takes two more, backward. Now the music starts, and it's heady, as fast as a racing pulse. Women run into the open, bells on, little cymbals on their fingers tinkling, stripping off veils and cloaks as they go. They form two lines and begin a dance of leaping and bending, of racing by pairs down between two lines of other girls, hand in hand, twirling, whirling. Some girls are raising arms to heaven, leaping so high they seem to hover in the sky before landing on their toes or on their knees. One girl lifts another, and then all go through the line, arms high, two by two, skipping through the sand. Someone pushes him once, and then again. It's Shawmy. How has he gotten into the dancer's midst? Chorus doesn't know these Theban dances. But other young fighters are joining in, clapping hands, grabbing girls by the waist and lifting them high, turning with them, rolling them over their backs, back to back, letting girls leap over them. In the line of dancers, skipping down between the rows of men and girls, he grabs Shawmy by the hand and twirls her, then lets her go. She spins and spins around. Then another girl leaps toward her, and both of them skip with him between the line of men and girls. Everyone starts swirling through the gauntlet, take a girl by the waist, spin her once, let go, take the next, hand on her waist, her right hand to your right hand, just a touch and you go on, and now some couples are pivoting one another, their feet nearly touch each other, fingers entwined, leaning back and out, round and round. He and Shomi are spinning, feet moving so fast they're blurry to his eyes.